he asked abruptly, as if in great dread. Did you have a premonition of my journey? Kristen shook her head. I couldn't sleep. Brother-in-law, what is it? Andres is so ill, Kristen. We fear for his life, so we thought... We know you are the most practiced woman in such matters. You must remember that he's the son of your own sister. Will you agree to come with me to tend to him? You know that I wouldn't come to you in this manner if I didn't think the boy's life were in peril, he implored her. He repeated these words inside the hut to Erland, who sat up in bed, groggy with sleep and quietly surprised. He tried to comfort Simon, speaking from experience. Such young children grew easily feverish and jabbered deliriously if they caught the least cold. Perhaps it was not as dangerous as it looked. You know full well, Erland, that I would not have come to get Kristen at such an hour of the night if I hadn't clearly seen that the child is lying there, struggling with death. Kristen had blown on the embers and put on more wood. Simon sat and stared into the fire, greedily drinking the milk she offered him, but refusing to eat any food. He wanted to head back down as soon as the others arrived. If you are willing, Kristen. One of his men was following behind with a widow who was a servant at Formo, an able woman who could take over the work up here while she was away. Åsbjørg was most capable, he said again. After Simon had lifted Kristen up into the saddle, he said, I'd prefer to take the shortcut to the south, if you're not adverse to it. Kristen had never been on that part of the mountain, but she knew there was supposed to be a path down to the valley, cutting steeply across the slope opposite Formo. She agreed, but then his servant would have to take the other road and ride past Urengard to get her chest and the pouches of herbs and bulbs. He should wake up Gauta. The boy knew best about these things. At the edge of a large marsh, they were able to ride side by side, and Kristen asked Simon to tell her again about the boy's illness. The children of Formo had had sore throats around St. Olaf's Day, but they had quickly recovered. The illness had come over Andres suddenly, while he seemed in the best of health, in the middle of the day, 3 days before. Simon had taken him along, and he was going to ride on the grain sledge down to the fields. But then Andres complained that he was cold, and when Simon looked at the boy, he was shivering so hard that his teeth were rattling in his mouth. Then came the burning fever and the coughing. He vomited up such quantities of loathsome brown matter and had such pain in his chest. But he couldn't tell them much about where it hurt most, the poor little boy. Kristen tried to reassure Simon as best she could, and then she had to ride behind him for a while. Once he turned around to ask whether she was cold. He wanted her to take his cape over her cloak. Then he spoke again of his son. He had noticed that the boy wasn't strong. But Andres had grown much more robust during the summer and fall. His foster mother thought so too. The last few days before he fell ill, he had acted a little strange and skittish. Scared, he had said when the dogs leaped at him, wanting to play. On the day when the fever seized him, Simon had come home in the first rays of dawn with several wild ducks. Usually the boy liked to borrow the birds his father brought home and play with them, but this time Andres screamed loudly when his father swung the bundle toward him. Later he crept over to touch the birds, but when he got blood on his hands, he grew quite wild with terror. And now, this evening, he lay whimpering so terribly, unable to sleep or rest, and then he screamed something about a hawk that was after him. Do you remember that day in Oslo, when the messenger arrived? You said, it will be your descendant who will live on at Formo after you're gone. Don't talk like that, Simon. As if you think you will die without a son. Surely God and his gentle mother will help. It's unlike you to be so disheartened, brother-in-law.
Hofrid, my first wife, said the same thing to me after she gave birth to our son.
Did you know that I had a son with her, Kristen?
Yes. But Andres is already in his third year. It's during the first 2 years that it's the most difficult to protect a child's life.
But even to her, these words seemed to offer little help. They rode and rode. The horses plodded up a slope, nodding and casting their heads about so the harnesses jangled. Not a sound in the frosty night except the sound of their own passage
and occasionally the rush of water as they crossed a stream, and the moon shining on everything. The scree and the rocky slopes glistened as hideously as death as they rode along beneath the cliffs. Finally, they reached a place where they could look down into the countryside. The moonlight filled the whole valley. The river and marshes and lake farther south gleamed like silver. The fields and meadows were pale.
"Tonight there's frost in the valley, too," said Simon.
He dismounted and walked along, leading Kristen's horse down the hillside. The path was so steep in many places that she hardly dared look ahead. Simon supported her by keeping his back against her knee, and she held on by putting one hand behind on the horse's flank. A stone would sometimes roll from under the horse's hooves, tumbling downward, pausing for a moment, and then continuing to roll, loosening more on the way and carrying them along. Finally, they reached the bottom. They rode across the barley fields north of the manor, between the rime-covered shocks of grain. There was an eerie rustling and clattering in the aspen trees above them in the silent, bright night.
"Is it true," asked Simon, wiping his face with his sleeve, "that you had no premonition?"
Kristen told him it was true. He went on,
"I've heard that it does happen. A premonition can appear if a person yearns strongly for someone. Romborg and I talked about it several times, that if you had been home, you might have known."
"None of you has entered my thoughts all this time," said Kristen. "You must believe me, Simon."
But she couldn't see it gave him much solace.
In the courtyard, a couple of servants appeared at once to take their horses.
"Things are just as you left them, Simon. Not any worse," one of them said quickly.
He had glanced up to the master's face.
Simon nodded. He walked ahead of Kristen toward the women's house.
Kristen could see that there was indeed grave danger. The little boy lay alone in the large, fine bed, moaning and gasping, ceaselessly tossing his head from side to side on the pillows. His face was fiery hot and dark red. He lay with his glistening eyes partially open, struggling to breathe. Simon stood holding Romborg's hand, and all the women of the estate who had gathered in the room crowded around Kristen as she examined the boy. But she spoke as calmly as she could and comforted the parents as best she could. It was probably lung fever. But this night would soon be over without any turn for the worse. It was the nature of this illness that it usually turned on the third or sixth or ninth night before the rooster crowed. She told Romborg to send all the serving women to bed except for two, so that she would always have rested maids to help her. When the servant returned from Jurengard with her healing things, she brewed a sweat-inducing potion for the boy and then lanced a vein in his foot so the fluids would be drawn away from his chest. Romborg's face blanched when she saw her child's blood. Simon put his arm around her, but she pushed her husband away and sat down on a chair at the foot of the bed. There she stayed, staring at Kristen with her big dark eyes while her sister tended to the child. Later in the day, when the boy seemed to be a little better, Kristen persuaded Romborg to lie down on a bench. She arranged pillows and blankets around the young woman and sat near her head, stroking her forehead gently. Romborg took Kristen's hand.
"You only wish us well, don't you?" she asked with a moan.
"Why shouldn't I wish you well, sister? The two of us, living here in our village once again, the only ones remaining of our kinsmen?"
Romborg uttered several small, stifled sobs from between her tightly pressed lips.
Kristen had seen her young sister cry only once, when they stood at their father's deathbed. Now a few swift little tears rose up and trickled down her cheeks. Romborg lifted Kristen's hand and stared at it. It was big and slender, but reddish-brown now, and rough.
"And yet, it's more beautiful than mine," she said.
Romborg's hands were small and white, but her fingers were short and her nails square.
"Yes, it is,"
she said, almost angrily when Kristen shook her head and laughed lightly.
"And you're still more lovely than I have ever been. Our father and mother loved you more than me all their days. You caused them sorrow and shame. I was docile and obedient and set my sights on the man they most wanted me to marry. And yet they loved you more. No, sister. They were just as fond of you. Be happy, Romborg, that you never gave them anything but joy. You cannot know how heavy the other is to bear. But they were younger back when I was young. Perhaps that was why they talked to me more.
Yes. I think everybody was younger back when you were young, said Romborg, and sighed again.
A short time later, she fell asleep. Kristen sat and looked at her. She had known her sister so little. Romborg was a child when she herself was wed. It seemed to her that in some ways her sister had remained a child. As she sat beside her ill son, she looked like a child, a pale, scared child who was trying stubbornly to fend off terror and misfortune. Sometimes an animal would stop growing if it had young ones too soon. Romborg was not even 16 when she gave birth to her daughter. And ever since she had never seemed to grow properly again, she continued to be slender and small, lacking in vigor and fertility. She had given birth only to one boy since then, and he was oddly weak, with a handsome face, fair and fine, but so pitifully frail and small. He had learned to walk late, and he still talked so poorly that only those who were with him every day could understand any of his chatter. He was also so shy and peevish with strangers that Kristen had hardly even touched her nephew until now. If only God and Holy Olaf would grant her the joy to save this poor small boy, she would thank them for it all her days. The mother was such a child herself that she wouldn't be able to bear losing him. And Kristen realized that for Simon Dara, it would also be terribly difficult to bear if his only son were taken from him. That she had become deeply fond of her brother-in-law became most apparent to her now as she saw how much he was suffering from fear and grief. No doubt she could understand her own father's great love for Simon Andresen. And yet she wondered whether he might have done wrong by Romborg when he was in such haste to arrange this marriage. For as she gazed down at her little sister, she thought that Simon must be both too old and much too somber and steadfast to be the husband of this young child. Chapter 3. The days passed, and Andres remained ill in bed. There were no great changes, either for the worse or for the better. The worst thing was that he got almost no sleep. The boy would lie with his eyes half open, seeming not to recognize anyone, his thin little body racked by coughs, gasping for breath, the fever rising and falling. One evening, Kristen had given him a soothing drink, and then calm descended on him. But after a while, she saw that the child had turned pale blue, and his skin felt cold and clammy. Quickly, she poured warm milk down his throat and placed heated stones at the soles of his feet. Then she didn't dare give him any more sleeping potions. She realized that he was too young to tolerate them. Sira Solmun came and brought the sacred vessels from the church to him. Simon and Romborg promised prayers, fasts, and alms if God would hear them and grant their son his life. Erlan stopped by one day. He declined to get down from his horse and go inside, but Kristen and Simon came out to the courtyard to talk to him. He gave them a look of great distress. And yet that expression of his had always annoyed Kristen in an oddly vague and unclear way. No doubt Erlan felt aggrieved whenever he saw anyone either sad or ill, but he seemed mostly perplexed or embarrassed. He looked genuinely bewildered when he felt sad for someone. After that, either Nokva or the twins would come to Formo each day to ask about Andres. The sixth night brought no change, but later the following day the boy seemed a little better. He was not quite as feverish. Simon and Kristen were sitting alone with him around midday. The father pulled out a gilded amulet he wore on a string around his neck under his clothing. He bent down over the boy, dangling the amulet before his eyes and then putting it in the child's hand, closing the small fingers around it. But Andres didn't seem to take any notice.
Simon had been given this amulet when he himself was a child, and he had worn it ever since. His father had brought it back from France. It had been blessed at a cloister called Mont Saint-Michel, and it bore a picture of Saint Michael with great wings. Andres liked to look at it, Simon explained softly. But the little boy thought it was a rooster. He called the greatest of all the angels a rooster. At long last, Simon had managed to teach the boy to say angel. But one day when they were out in the courtyard, Andres saw the rooster screeching at one of the hens, and he said,
"The angel's mad now, father."
Kristen looked up at the man with pleading eyes. It cut her to the heart to listen to him, even though Simon was speaking in such a calm and even voice. And she was so worn out after keeping vigil all these nights. She realized that it would not be good for her to begin weeping now. Simon stuck the amulet back inside his shirt. "Ah, well. I will give a 3-year-old ox to the church on the eve of St. Michael's Day every autumn for as long as I live, if he will wait a little longer to come for this soul. He'd be no more than a bony chicken on the balance scale, Andres, as small as he is." But when Simon tried to laugh, his voice broke.
"Simon, Simon," she implored.
"Yes, things will happen as they must, Kristen. And God himself will decide. Surely he knows best." The father said no more as he stood gazing down at his son. On the eighth night, Simon and one of the maids kept watch as Kristen dozed on a bench some distance away. When she woke up, the girl was asleep. Simon sat on the bench with a high back, as he had on most nights. He was sitting with his face bent over the bed and the child.
"Is he sleeping?"
whispered Kristen as she came forward. Simon raised his head. He ran his hand over his face. She saw that his cheeks were wet, but he replied in a calm, quiet voice, "I don't think that Andres will have any sleep, Kristen, until he lies under the turf in consecrated ground." Kristen stood there as if paralyzed. Slowly her face turned pale beneath the tan until it was white all the way to her lips. Then she went back to her corner and picked up her outer garments.
"You must arrange things so that you are alone in here when I come back."
She spoke as if her throat and mouth were parched.
"Sit with him, and when you see me enter, don't say a word. And never speak of this again, not to me or to anyone else, not even to your priest."
Simon got to his feet and slowly walked over to her. He too had grown pale.
"No, Kristen."
His voice was almost inaudible. "I don't dare for you to do this thing." She put on her cloak, then took a linen cloth from the chest in the corner, folded it up, and hid it in her bodice.
"But I dare. You understand that no one must come near us afterward until I call. No one must come near us or speak to us until he wakes up and speaks himself."
"What do you think your father would say of this?" he whispered in the same faint voice.
"Kristen, don't do it. In the past, I have done things that my father thought were wrong. Back then, it was merely to further my own desire. Andres is his flesh and blood too. My own flesh, Simon. My only sister's son."
Simon took in a heavy, trembling breath. He stood with his eyes downcast.
"But if you don't want me to make this last attempt?"
He stood as before, with his head bowed, and did not reply. Then Kristen repeated her question, unaware that an odd little smile, almost scornful, had appeared on her white lips.
"Do you not want me to go?"
He turned his head away. And so she walked past him, stepped soundlessly out the door, and closed it silently behind her. It was pitch dark outside, with small gusts of wind from the south making all the stars blink and flicker uneasily. She had reached no farther than the road up between the fences when she felt as if she had stepped into eternity itself. An endless path both behind her and up ahead. As if she would never emerge from what she had entered into when she walked out into this night. Even the darkness was like a force she was pressing against. She plodded through the mud. The road had been churned up by the carts carrying unthreshed grain, and now it was thawing in the south wind. With every footstep, she had to pull herself free from the night, and the raw chill that clung to her feet swept upward and weighted down the hems of her garments. Now and then a falling leaf would drift past her, as if something alive were touching her in the dark, gentle but confident of its superior power. Turn back. When she came out onto the main road, it was easier to walk. The road was covered with grass, and her feet did not get stuck in the mire. Her face felt as rigid as stone, her body tensed and taut. Each step carried her mercilessly toward the forest grove through which she would have to pass. A feeling rose up inside her like an inner paralysis. She couldn't possibly walk through that patch of darkness. But she had no intention of turning around. She couldn't feel her body because of her terror, yet all the while she kept moving forward, as if in her sleep, steadily stepping over stones and roots and puddles of water, unconsciously careful not to stumble or break her steady stride, and thus allow fear to overwhelm her. Now the spruce trees rustled closer and closer in the night. She stepped in among them, still as calm as a sleepwalker. She sensed every sound and hardly dared blink because of the dark. The drone of the river, the heavy sighing of the firs, a creek trickling over stones as she walked toward it, passed by it, and then continued on. Once a rock slid down the scree, as if some living creature were moving about up there. Sweat poured from her body, but she did not venture either to slow or to speed her step because of it. Kristen's eyes had now grown so accustomed to the dark that when she emerged from the woods, she could see much better. A glint came from the ribbon of the river and from the water on the marshes. The fields became visible in the blackness. The clusters of buildings looked like clumps of earth. The sky was also beginning to lighten overhead. She could feel it, although she didn't dare look up at the black peaks towering above. But she knew that it would soon be time for the moon to rise. She tried to remind herself that in 4 hours it would be daytime. People would be setting about their daily chores on all the farms throughout the countryside. The sky would grow pale with dawn. The light would rise over the mountains. Then it wouldn't seem far to go. In the daylight, it wasn't far from Formo to the church, and by then she would have returned home long ago. But it was clear that she would be a different person. She knew that if it had been one of her own children, she would not have dared make this last attempt. To turn away God's hand when he reached out for a living soul. When she kept watch over her own ill children, back when she was young and her heart bled with tenderness, when she thought she would collapse in anguish and torment, she had tried to say, "Lord, you love them better than I do. Let thy will be done." But now on this night she was walking alone, defying her own terror. This child who was not her own, she would save him, no matter what fate she was saving him for. Because you too, Simon Dara, acquiesced when the dearest thing you possessed on earth was at stake. You agreed to more than anyone can accept with full honor. Do you not want me to go? He hadn't been man enough to answer. Deep in her heart, she knew that if the child died, Simon would have the strength to bear this too. But she had struck at the only moment when she ever saw him on the verge of breaking down. She had seized hold of that moment and carried it off. She would share that secret with him, the knowledge that she had also witnessed him when he once stood unsteady on his feet. For he had learned too much about her. She had accepted help from the man she had spurned every time it was a matter of saving the one she had chosen. This suitor whom she had cast aside, he was the man she had turned to each time she needed someone to protect her love. And never had she asked for Simon's help in vain. Time after time he had stepped forward, covering her with his kindness and his strength. So she was undertaking this nighttime errand to rid herself of a little of the debt. Until that hour, she hadn't fully realized how heavy a burden it was. Simon had forced her to see at last that he was the strongest. stronger than she was, and stronger than the man to whom she had chosen to give herself. No doubt she had realized this from the moment all three of them met, face to face, in that shameful place in Oslo. And yet she had refused to accept it then, that such a plump-cheeked, stout, and gaping young man could be stronger than. Now she was walking along, not daring to call on a good and holy name. She took upon herself this sin in order to... She didn't know what. Was it revenge? Revenge because she had been forced to see that he was more noble-minded than the two of them? But now you too understand, Simon, that when the life of the one you love more than your own heart is at stake, then the poor person grasps for anything, anything. The moon had risen over the mountain ridge as she walked up the hill to the church. Again she felt as if she had to overcome a new wave of terror. The moonlight lay like a delicate spider web over the tar-timbered edifice. The church itself looked terrifying and ominously dark beneath the thin veil. Out on the green she saw the cross, but for the first time she didn't dare approach to kneel before the blessed tree. She crept over the churchyard wall at the place where she knew the sod and stone were the lowest and most easily breached. Here and there a gravestone glistened like water in the tall, dewy grass. Kristen walked straight across the cemetery to the graves of the poor, which lay near the south wall. She went over to the burial place of a poor man who had been a stranger in the parish. One winter the man had frozen to death on the mountainside. His two motherless daughters had been taken in by one farm after another, until Lavrans Bjørgolfsson had offered to keep them and bring them up, for the sake of Christ. When they were full grown and had turned out well, Kristen's father had found honorable, hard-working husbands for them, and married them off with cows and calves and sheep. Ronfrid had given them bedding and iron pots. Now both women were well provided for, as befitted their station. One of them had been Romborg's maid, and Romborg had carried the woman's child to be baptized. "So you must grant me a bit of the turf covering you, Bjarne, for Romborg's son." Kristen knelt down and pulled out her dagger. Drops of ice-cold sweat prickled her brow and upper lip as she dug her fingers under the dew-drenched sod. The earth resisted. It was only roots. She sliced through them with the dagger. In return, the ghost must be given gold or silver that had been passed down through three generations. She slipped off the little gold ring with the rubies that had been her grandmother's betrothal ring. "The child is my father's descendant." She pushed the ring as far down into the earth as she could, wrapped the piece of sod in the linen cloth, and then spread peat and leaves over the spot where she had removed it. When she stood up, her legs trembled under her, and she had to pause for a moment before she could turn around. If she looked under her arm right now, she would be able to see them. She felt a terrible tugging inside her, as if they would force her to do so. "All the dead who had known her before in this world. Is that you, Kristen Lavrans' daughter? Are you coming here in this way?" Arne Geirdsson lay buried outside the west entrance. "Yes, Arne. You may well wonder. I was not like this, back when you and I knew each other." Then she climbed over the wall again and headed down the slope. The moon was now bright over the countryside. Jorungarde lay out on the plain. The dew glittered in the grass on all the rooftops. She stared in that direction, almost listlessly. She felt as if she herself were dead to that home and all the people there. The door was closed to her. To the woman who had wandered past, up along the road on this night. The mountains cast their shadows over her nearly the whole way back. The wind was blowing harder now. One gust of wind after another came straight toward her. Withered leaves blew against her, trying to send her back to the place she had just left. Nor did she believe that she was walking along unaccompanied. She heard the steady sound of stealthy footsteps behind her. "Is that you, Arne? Look back, Kristen. Look under your arm," it urged her. And yet she didn't feel truly afraid anymore. Just cold and numb, sick with desire to give up and sink down. After this night, she could never be afraid of anything else in the world. Simon was sitting in his usual place at the head of the bed, leaning over the child, when she opened the door and stepped inside. For a brief moment he looked up. Kristen wondered if she had grown as worn out and haggard and old as he had during these days. Then Simon bowed his head and hid his face with his arm. He staggered a bit as he got to his feet. He turned his face away from her as he walked past and over to the door, his head bowed, his shoulders slumped. Kristen lit two candles and set them on the table. The boy opened his eyes slightly and looked up, his gaze strangely unseeing. He whimpered a bit and tried to turn his head toward the light. When Kristen straightened out his little body, the way a corpse is laid out, he tried to change position, but he seemed too weak to move. Then she covered his face and chest with a linen cloth and placed the strip of sod on top. At that moment, the terror seized her again, like a great sea swell. She had to sit down on the bed. The window was right above the short bench, and she didn't dare sit with her back to it. Better to look them in the eyes if anyone should be standing outside and looking in. She pulled the high-backed chair over to the bed and sat down facing the window pane. The stifling black of the night pressed against it. One of the candles was reflected in the glass. Kristen fixed her eyes on it, clutching the arms of the chair so that her knuckles grew white. Now and then her arms trembled. She couldn't feel her own legs, as chilled and wet as they were. She sat there with her teeth chattering from horror and cold, and the sweat ran like ice water down her face and back. She sat without moving, merely casting now and then a quick glance at the linen cloth, which faintly rose and fell with the child's breath. Finally, the pale light of dawn appeared in the windowpane. The rooster crowed shrilly. Then she heard men out in the courtyard. They were heading for the stable. She slumped against the back of the chair, shuddering as if with convulsions, and tried to find a position for her legs so they wouldn't twitch and jerk around from the shaking. There was a strong movement under the linen cloth. Andres pushed it away from his face, whimpering crossly. He seemed partially conscious since he grunted at Kristen when she jumped to her feet and leaned over him. She grabbed the cloth and sod, rushed over to the fireplace, and stuffed twigs and wood inside it. Then she threw the ghostly goods into the fresh crackling fire. She had to stand still for a moment, holding on to the wall. The tears poured down Kristen's face. She took a ladle full of milk from the little pot that stood near the hearth and carried it over to the child. Andres had fallen asleep again. He seemed to be slumbering peacefully now. Then she drank the milk herself. It tasted so good that she had to gulp down two or three more ladlefuls of the warm drink. Still, she didn't dare speak. The boy hadn't yet said a comprehensible word. But she sank to her knees next to the foot of the bed and recited mutely to herself. Convertere, Domine, oli quantulum, e deprecare super servos tuos, ne ultra memineres inquitadis nostre, ecce rispice, populus tuos omnes nos. Yes, yes, yes. This was a terrible thing she had done. But he was their only son, while she herself had seven. Shouldn't she try everything to save her sister's only son? All the thoughts she had had during the night, they were merely ramblings of the night. She had done it only because she couldn't stand to see this child die in her hands. Simon, the man who had never failed her, the one who had been loyal and good toward every child she had ever known, and most of all toward herself and her own. And this son whom he loved above all else, shouldn't she use every measure to save the boy's life, even if it was a sin? Yes, it was sinful, but let the punishment fall on me, God. That poor, beautiful, innocent son of Simon and Romborg. God would not allow Andres to be punished. She went back and leaned over the bed, breathing on the tiny waxen hand. She didn't dare kiss it. He mustn't be wakened. So fair and blameless. It was during the nights of terror when they were left alone at Haugen that Fru Osshild had told her about it. Told her about her own errand to the cemetery at Kongunahelle. That, Kristen, was surely the most difficult task I have ever undertaken. But Bjorn Gunnarsson was not an innocent child when he lay there after Osshild Gauta's daughter's cousins had come too close to his heart with their swords. He had slain one man before he was brought down himself, and the other man never regained his vigor after the day he exchanged blows with Herr Bjorn. Kristen stood at the window and looked out into the courtyard. Servants were moving from building to building, going about the day's chores. Several young calves were roaming about the yard. They were so lovely. Many different thoughts rise up in the darkness. Like those gossamer plants that grow in the lake, oddly bewitching and pretty as they bob and sway. But enticing and sinister, they exert a dark pull as long as they're growing in the living, trickling mire. And yet they're nothing but slimy brown clumps when the children pull them into the boat. So many strange thoughts, both terrifying and enticing, grow in the night. It was probably Brother Edvin who once said that those condemned to hell had no wish to give up their torment. Hatred and sorrow were their pleasures. That was why Christ could never save them. Back then, this had sounded to her like wild talk. An icy shiver ran through her. Now she was beginning to understand what the monk had meant. She leaned over the bed once more, breathing in the smell of the little child. Simon and Romborg were not going to lose him. Even though she had done it out of a need to prove herself to Simon, to show him that she could do something other than take from him, she had needed to take a risk on his behalf. To repay him. Then she knelt again, repeating over and over as much as she could remember from the prayer book. That morning, Simon went out and sowed winter rye in the newly plowed field south of the grove. He had decided he must act as if this were merely reasonable, because the work on the estate had to continue as usual. The serving maids had been greatly surprised when he went into them during the night, to tell them that Kristen wanted to be alone with the boy until she sent word. He said the same to Romborg when she got up. Kristen had requested that no one should go near the women's house that day. "Not even you?" she asked quickly, and Simon said no. That was when he went out to get the seed box. But after the midday meal, he stayed up at the manor. He didn't have the heart to go far from the buildings. And he didn't like the look in Romborg's eyes. A short time after the noonday rest, it happened. He was standing down by the grain barn when he saw his wife racing across the courtyard. He rushed after her. Romborg threw herself at the door to the women's house, pounding on it with her fists and screaming shrilly for Kristen to open up. Simon put his arms around her, speaking gently. Then she bent down as fast as lightning and bit him on the hand. He saw that she was like a raging beast. "He's my child! What had the two of you done to my son?" "You know full well that your sister wouldn't do anything to Andres, except what might do him good." When he put his arms around her again, Romborg struggled and screamed. "Come now, Romborg," said her husband, making his voice stern. "Aren't you ashamed in front of our servants?" But she kept on screaming. "He's mine, that much I know. You weren't with us when I gave birth to him, Simon," she shouted. "We weren't so precious to you back then." "You know what I had on my hands at the time," replied her husband wearily. He dragged her across to the main house. He had to use all his strength. After that, he didn't dare leave her side. Romborg gradually calmed down, and when evening came, she obediently allowed her maids to help her undress. Simon stayed up. His daughters were asleep over in their bed, and he had sent the serving women away. Once, when he stood up and walked across the room, Romborg asked from her bed where he was going.
Her voice sounded wide awake.
I was thinking of lying down with you for a while, he said after a moment. He took off his outer garments and shoes, and then crawled under the blanket and woolen coverlet. He put his arm around his wife's shoulders. I realized, my Romborg, that this has been a long and difficult day for you.
Your heart is beating so hard, Simon, she said a little later.
Well, I'm afraid for the boy too, you know. But we must wait patiently until Kristen sends us word.
He sat up abruptly in bed, propping himself up on one elbow. In bewilderment, he stared at Kristen's white face. It was right above his own, glistening wet with tears in the candlelight. Her hand was on his chest. For a moment, he thought. But this time he wasn't merely dreaming. Simon threw himself back against the headboard, and with a stifled moan, he covered his face with his arm. He felt sick. His heart was hammering inside him, furious and hard.
Simon, wake up! Kristen shook him again. Andres is calling for his father. Do you hear me? It was the first thing he said.
Her face was beaming with joy as her tears fell steadily. Simon sat up, rubbing his face several times. Surely he hadn't spoken in confusion when she woke him. He looked up at Kristen, who was standing next to the bed with a lantern in her hand. Quietly, so as not to wake Romborg, he crept out of the room with her. The loathsome nausea was still lodged in his chest. He felt as if something were about to burst inside him. Why couldn't he stop having that dreadful dream? He who in his waking hours struggled and struggled to drive all such thoughts from his mind. But when he lay asleep, powerless and defenseless, he would have that dream, which the devil himself must have sent. Even now, while he sat and kept watch over his deathly ill son, he dreamed like some kind of demon. It was raining, and Kristen had no idea what time of night it might be. The boy had been half conscious, but he hadn't spoken. And it was only when night came and she thought he was sleeping comfortably and soundly that she dared lie down for a moment to rest, with Andres in her arms so she would notice if he stirred. Then she had fallen asleep. The boy looked so tiny as he lay alone in the bed. He was terribly pale, but his eyes were clear, and his face lit up with a smile when he saw his father. Simon dropped to his knees beside the bed, but when he reached out to lift the small body into his embrace, Kristen grabbed him by the arm.
No, no, Simon. He's soaked with sweat, and it's cold in here.
She pulled the covers tighter around Andres. Lie down next to him instead, while I send word for a maid to keep watch. I'll go back to the main house now and get into bed with Romborg.
Simon crept under the covers. There was a warm hollow where she had lain, and the faint, sweet scent of her hair on the pillowcase. Simon quietly uttered a moan, and then he gathered up his little son and pressed his face against the child's damp, soft hair. Andres had become so small that he felt like nothing in Simon's arms, but he lay there contentedly, occasionally saying a word or two. Then he began tugging and poking at the opening of his father's shirt. He stuck his clammy little hand inside and pulled out the amulet.
The rooster, he said happily. There it is.
On the day of Kristen's departure, as she made ready to leave, Simon came to see her in the women's house and handed her a little wooden box.
I thought this was something you might like to have.
Kristen knew from the carving that it was the work of her father. Inside, wrapped in a soft piece of glove leather, was a tiny gold clasp set with 5 emeralds. She recognized it at once. Lavrans had worn it on his shirt whenever he wanted to look particularly fine. She thanked Simon, but then she turned blood red. She suddenly remembered that she had never seen her father wear this clasp since she had come home from the convent in Oslo.
When did father give this to you?
She regretted the question the moment she asked it. He gave it to me as a farewell gift one time when I was leaving the estate.
This seems to me much too great a gift.
she said softly, looking down. Simon chuckled and replied, "You're going to need many such things, Kristen, when the time comes for you to send out all your sons with betrothal gifts." Kristen looked at him and said, "You know what I mean, Simon. Those things that my father gave you. You know that I'm as fond of you as if you had been his own son.
Are you?"
He placed the back of his hand against her cheek and gave it a fleeting caress as he smiled, an odd little smile, and spoke as if to a child. "Yes, yes, Kristen. I know that." Chapter 4 Later that fall, Simon Andresen had business with his brother at Diefrin. While he was there, a suitor was proposed for his daughter Arnjord. The matter was not settled, and Simon felt rather uneasy and apprehensive as he rode northward. Perhaps he ought to have agreed, then the child would have been well provided for, and he could stop all his worrying about her future. Perhaps Geird and Helga were right. It was foolish of him not to seize hold with both hands when he received such an offer for this daughter of his. Eiken was a bigger estate than Formo, and Osmund himself owned more than a third of it. He would never have thought of proposing his son as a suitor for a maiden of such birth as Arnjord. Of lowly lineage and with no kin on her mother's side, if Simon hadn't held a mortgage on a portion of the estate worth 3 marks in taxes, the family had been forced to borrow money from both Diefrin and the nuns in Oslo when Grunne Osmundsen happened to slay a man for the second time. Grunne grew wild when he was drunk, although he was otherwise an upright and well-meaning fellow, said Geird, and surely he would allow himself to be guided by such a good and sensible woman as Arnjord. But the fact was that Grunne was not many years younger than Simon himself, and Arnjord was young, and the people at Eiken wanted the wedding to take place as early as spring. It hung on like a bad memory in Simon's mind. He tried not to think of it if he could avoid it. But now that Arnjord's marriage had come under discussion, it kept cropping up. He had been an unhappy man on that first morning when he woke up at Romborg's side. Certainly, he had been no more giddy or bold than a bridegroom ought to be when he went to bed, although it had made him feel strange and reckless to see Kristen among the bride's attendants, and Erlung, his new brother-in-law, was among the men who escorted him up to the loft. But when he woke up the next morning and lay there looking at his bride, who was still asleep, he had felt a terrible, painful shame deep in his heart, as if he had mistreated a child. And yet he knew that he could have spared himself this sorrow. But she had laughed when she opened her big eyes. "Now you're mine, Simon." She ran her hands over his chest. "My father is your father, and my sister is your sister." And he grew cold with anguish, for he wondered whether she knew that his heart had given a start at her words. Otherwise, he was quite content with his marriage. This much he firmly believed. His wife was wealthy, of distinguished lineage, young and lively, beautiful and kind. She had borne him a daughter and a son, and that was something a man valued after he had tried living among riches without producing any children who could keep the estate together after the parents were gone. 2 children, and their position was assured. He was so rich that he could even obtain a good match for Arnjord. He would have liked to have another son. Yes, he wouldn't be sad if 1 or 2 more children were born on Formo. But Romborg was probably happy as long as she was spared all that. And that was worth something, too. For he couldn't deny that things were much more comfortable at home when Romborg was in good humor. He might well have wished that she had a more even temperament. He didn't always know how he stood with his wife. And more attention could have been paid to the housekeeping in his home. But no man should dare expect to have all his bowls filled to the brim, as the saying goes. This is what Simon kept telling himself as he rode homeward. Romborg was to travel to Kruka during the week before St. Clemens Day. It always cheered her up to get away from home for a while. God only knew how things would go over there this time around. Sigrid was now carrying her 8th child. Simon had been shocked when he paid a visit to his sister on his way south. She didn't look as if she could stand much more. He had offered 4 thick wax tapers to the ancient image of the Virgin Mary at Eyabu, which was supposed to be particularly powerful in effecting miracles, and he had promised many gifts if Sigrid made it through with her life and her health. How things would go with Germund and all their children if the mother died and left them behind? No, he couldn't think about that. They lived together so well, Sigrid and Germund. Never had she heard an unkind word from her husband, she said. Never had he left anything undone that he thought might please her. When he noticed that Sigrid was wasting away with longing for the child she had borne in her youth with Jarvald Arnason, he had asked Simon to bring the boy to visit so the mother could spend some time with him. But Sigrid had reaped only sorrow and disappointment from the reunion with that spoiled rich man's son. Since then, Sigrid Andrasdottir had clung to her husband and the children she had with him, the way a poor, ailing sinner clings to her priest and confession. Now she seemed fully content in many ways, and Simon understood why. Few men were as pleasant to be with as Germund. He had such a fine voice that even if he was only talking about the narrow-hoofed horse that had been foisted upon him, it was almost like listening to harp music. Germund Harsteinsson had always had a strange and ugly face, but in the past he had been a strong man, with a handsome build and limbs, the best bowman and hunter, and better than most in all sports. 3 years ago he had become a cripple, after he returned to the village from a hunting expedition, crawling on his hands and one knee, with the other leg crushed and dragging behind him. Now he couldn't walk across the room without a cane, and he couldn't mount a horse or hobble around the steep slopes of the fields without help. Misfortune constantly plagued him, such an odd and eccentric man as he was, and ill-prepared for safeguarding his property or welfare. Anyone who had the heart for it could fool him in trade or business dealings. But he was clever with his hands, an able craftsman in both wood and iron, and a wise and skilled speaker. And when this man took his harp on his lap, Germund could make people laugh or cry with his singing and playing. It was almost like listening to the knight in Germund's song, who could entice the leaves from the linden tree and the horn from the lively cattle with his playing. Then the older children would take up the refrain and sing along with their father. They were more lovely to hear than the chiming of all the bells in the bishop's hamar. The next youngest child, Inga, could walk if she held onto the bench, although she had not yet learned to talk. But she would hum and sing all day long, and her tiny voice was so light and delicate, like a tiny little silver bell. They lived crowded together in a small, dark old hearth house, the man and his wife, the children, and the servants. The loft, which Germund had talked of building all these years, would now probably never be built. He had barely managed to put up a new barn to replace the one that had burned the previous year, but the parents couldn't bear to part with a single one of their many children. Every time he visited Kruka, Simon had offered to take some of them in and raise them. Germund and Sigrid had thanked him, but declined. Simon sometimes thought that perhaps she was the one among his siblings who had found the best life after all, although Gerd did say that Astrid was quite pleased with her new husband. They lived far south in Ree County, and Simon hadn't seen them since their wedding. But Gerd had mentioned that the sons of Torgrim were constantly quarreling with their stepfather, and Gudmund was very happy and content. But if that was man's happiness, then Simon thought it would not be a sin to thank God that their father hadn't lived to see it. As soon as it could be decently permitted after Andres Dare's death, Gudmund had celebrated his wedding to the widow whom his father wouldn't allow him to marry. The Knight of Dyfrin thought that since he had sought out young, rich, and beautiful maidens of distinguished families, an unblemished reputation for his 2 eldest sons, and this had led to little joy for either Gerd or Simon, then it would mean pure misery for Gudmund if his father allowed him to follow his own foolish wishes. Tordis Berg's daughter was much older than Gudmund, moderately wealthy, and she had had no children from her first marriage. but afterward she had given birth to a daughter by one of the priests at the Maria Church in Oslo, and people said that she had been much too amenable toward other men as well, including Gudmund Dara, as soon as she became acquainted with him. She was as ugly as a troll, and much too rude and coarse in speech for a woman, thought Simon. But she was lively and witty, intelligent and good-natured. He knew that he would have been fond of Tordis himself, if only she hadn't married into their lineage. Now Gudmund was flourishing, and it was dreadful to witness. He was almost as stout and portly as Simon. And that was not Gudmund's nature. In his youth, he had been slender and handsome. He had grown so flabby and indolent that Simon felt an urge to give the boy a thrashing every time he saw him. But it was true that Gudmund had been a cursed simpleton all his days. And the fact that his children took their wits from their mother, but their looks from him, was at least one bit of luck in this misfortune. And yet Gudmund was thriving. So Simon didn't need to fret as much as he did over his brother. And in some ways it was probably also needless for him to lament on Gerd's behalf. But each time he went home to his father's manor and saw how things now stood there, he felt so dreadfully overwhelmed that his heart ached when he left. The wealth of the estate had increased. Gerd's brother-in-law, Ulf Saxason, now enjoyed the king's full favor and grace, and he had drawn Gerd Andresen into the circle of men who possessed the most power and advantages in the realm. But Simon didn't care for the man, and saw that Gerd apparently didn't either. Reluctantly and with little joy, Gerd of Difrin followed the course that his wife and her brother had set for him in order to have some peace in his house. Helga Sox's daughter was a witch. But it was Gerd's two sons who caused him to look as careworn as he did. Saxa, the older one, must be 16 winters old by now. Nearly every night his personal servant had to heave the whelp into bed, dead drunk. He had already ruined his mind and his health with liquor. No doubt he would drink himself to death before he reached the age of a man. It would be no great loss. Saxa had acquired an ugly reputation in the region for coarseness and insolence, in spite of his youth. He was his mother's favorite. Gerd loved Jon, his younger son, better. He also had more of the temperament needed for him to bring honor to his lineage. If only he hadn't been... Well, he was a bit misshapen, with hunched shoulders and a crooked back. And he had some kind of inner stomach complaint and was unable to tolerate any food other than gruel and flat bread. Simon Andresen had always taken secret refuge in a feeling of community with his family whenever his own life seemed to him, well, troublesome, or whatever he might call it. When he met with adversity, it bothered him less if he could remember the good fortune and well-being of his siblings. If only things had been the same at Difrin as during his father's time, when peace, contentment, and prosperity reigned, then Simon thought there would have been much to ease his secret distress. He felt as if the roots of his own life were intertwined with those of his brothers and sisters, somewhere deep down in the dark earth. Every blow that struck, every injury that ate away at the marrow of one of them, was felt by all. He and Gerd, at any rate, had felt this way, at least in the past. Now he wasn't so sure that Gerd felt the same anymore. He had been most fond of his older brother and of Sigrid. He remembered when they were growing up, he would sit and feel such joy for his youngest sister that he had to do something to show it. Then he would pick a quarrel with her, tease and needle her, pull on her braids and pinch her arm, as if he couldn't show his affection for her in any other way without feeling ashamed. He had to tease her so that without embarrassment he could give her all the treasures he had stashed away. He could include the little maiden in his games when he built a mill house at the creek, built farms for her, and cut willow whistles for the little girls in the springtime. The memory of that day when he learned the full extent of her misfortune was like a brand scorched onto his mind. All winter long he had seen the way Sigrid was grieving herself into the grave over her dead betrothed, but he didn't know any more than that. Then one Sunday in early spring he was standing on the gallery at Manvik, feeling cross with the women for not appearing. The horses were in the courtyard, outfitted with their church saddles, and the servants had been waiting a long time. Finally, he grew angry and went into the women's house.